Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. In our last program, we talked with state legislator Leah Whitford about the Round Table of the Crown of the Continent, an annual meeting which attempts to sustain and enhance culture, community, and conservation by connecting people. One of those people is Rich Jansen, tribal member of the Pend'oreille of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes. He is head of the tribe's Department of Natural Resources. Rich, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Well, I'm a Montanan, born in Bozeman, 1969, when both my parents were going to college at the Montana State University. We finally settled in Ronan in 1980, and where my mom's reservation was from, which is the Salish and Kootenai tribes. They're in western Montana. And I grew up there. I'm still in Ronan, the community that I love and have been a part of for many decades.
How about the rest of your education?
I graduated from Ronan High School in 1988 and then went to the University of Montana here in Missoula.
Majoring in what?
I was a forest resource management major, so a forester, essentially.
Okay, which is that your degree?
Yes, that's my undergraduate degree.
Graduate school?
Graduate school was Gonzaga University. I received my master's in business in 2007.
Why those two choices, forestry and business?
Well, I was a forester for 5 years, and, really I was just bored of being by myself. I was more of a social person. I wanted to be around people and be more interactive. As a forester, you're by yourself out in the woods. And don't get me wrong, I loved being out in the woods, and I was in great shape and kept kept the weight off. But, I just wanted to be around people. And so after about 5 years, I went into natural resource management with our tribes in 1998 and been a part of that department ever since.
When did you become head?
About four and a half years ago, I was hired by the Tribal Council to lead the Natural Resources Department for the Salish Kootenai Tribes.
Now, obviously, I'm not a tribal member, and so I base information that I get as secondhand rumor. The secondhand rumor that I've heard for a long time is when people who are non-tribal people look at all the tribes, they say, you guys do the best job of natural resource stewardship in the state. I'll ask you to comment on that in a second, but first tell me how many people in the department.
Well, our department has about 143 people, and you're talking, roughly 80 to 90 full-time employees, and then we swell in the summer to about 143 because we do a lot of work in the summer, our field season, essentially.
Okay. And you're stewarding about how many acres?
Well, there's 1.2 million acres on the Flathead Indian Reservation, including Flathead Lake, including all the water bodies, Nine Pipes area, which is full of potholes and wetlands, many different wildlife species located on the reservation, many different fish species located on the reservation. And our job is to manage the environment, fish and wildlife, and water resources within the exterior boundaries of the Flathead Indian Reservation.
Okay, that's roughly half the size of Yellowstone Park in rough numbers. That's a big piece of ground, and it's complex.
It is very complex.
Territory.
We have tribal lands there that we manage. We have fee lands that we work with landowners.
Fee lands meaning privately owned.
Privately owned on the reservation, correct.
Because quite a bit was sold, or I don't know the story.
In 1910, it was homesteaded. It was opened by the federal government to homesteaders.
They opened your reservation to homesteaders?
Right.
How was that done? I mean, I thought it was your land. You could sell it, but I didn't realize.
Well, by treaty it was. Treaty of 1855, July 16th, when it was signed and ratified. But, over time, the agent, Indian agent there in Ronan, his name was Peter Ronan, and he was against opening the Flathead Indian Reservation to homesteading. And as soon as he died, just before 1910, it was done. The federal government came in here in Missoula, which is present-day Missoula, and signed that treaty with the Salish, the Pend'oreille, and the Kootenai Band of Indians that were in the area at the time.
So in other words, from at least a formalistic standpoint, the tribal representatives agreed to this?
I don't know if you can say they agreed to it. I've heard stories that none of the tribes actually signed the document, just their X marks.
It is somewhat of an astonishing, just thinking legally as a lawyer for a minute here, the idea of opening, if it's my reservation, to outside homesteaders would be a non-starter if I was involved in the rational, fair discussion. That's why I ask.
Yeah, I think it was just the federal government just pushing it on the Indians at that time, my ancestors.
What's the mix now between tribal, if I'm using the correct terminology, tribal lands and fee lands that are not owned?
Well, our tribe has been very proactive on purchasing lands that were removed from tribal ownership in the past. Roughly right now, I can say approximately 66% of the 1.2 million acres is owned by the Salish Kootenai tribes or allottees or individual Indians that have land held in trust on the reservation. And then the rest is either state, because there are some state sections on the reservation, and there's some federal wildlife refuges that are also on the reservation. And then when you have four counties, meaning Sanders, Lake, Flathead, and Missoula, intermixed with the reservation, there's about, I'd say 25% is non-Indian owned or owned in fee, because tribal members can own land in fee status and pay property tax on those, such as myself.
That also sounds as though from a natural resources management standpoint, that's a lot of jurisdictions to be dealing with. Complicated. Fair or not?
It's difficult, and it has its challenges. Since I've been with the tribes, relationships have grown better over the years. This is not the 60s. It's not even the 80s. People are working together for the common good of the resource and for the economy of the Flathead Indian Reservation. For example, if we look at the county commissioners meet with the tribal council frequently during the year. I think they meet every few months or quarterly. And so you wouldn't have seen that back in the 80s. They came together on water rights because both entities knew that it would be good for the economy, it'd be good for the land to have certainty on water rights. You see those examples time and time again where our law enforcement agencies are working together. The county, the tribe, the state, meaning highway patrol, they work together in concert for a common goal, which is to keep our communities safe and our highways safe. That isn't natural resource management, but that is an example of how far we've come as a community. Rural communities, we come together and for the common good. All of us live together, go to school, the same public schools on the reservation. And one more example I think I can get is our water quality standards. Our water quality standards are approved by the US EPA, and that happened in the 90s. We're actually just as stringent, or if not more, on some water quality standards on waters of the U.S. is what we call them, but they're held in trust by the EPA for the tribes. And so, we work well with cities and municipalities such as Polson or Ronan to ensure, the degradation of the streams and the water bodies does not occur, and those treated waters are done in such a fashion that they can be put into the waters of the U.S. and be safe.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Rich Jansen, who is the department head of the Natural Resources Department of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes. It's interesting to hear about that sort of diverse cooperation. I had a limited experience directly. I did some facilitation between the tribes and fish, wildlife, and parks around bull trout, lake trout, which we're going to talk about in a minute. At that time, and I'm going to guess that's 4 or 5 years ago, and I've done a lot of facilitation, my sense was there were not only scientific differences of opinion based on research, but there was a mutual lack of confidence, and I would even say professional respect, among some key players on each side, tribal specialists, professionals, and fish, wildlife, and parks. And I felt it was, in some cases, I would say in one case, a guy, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, I felt if he was part of the discussion, they wouldn't make a deal because it was personal. How big a problem is that? Generally, it sounds like, however big it's been getting better. But is it still an issue? And I'm not speaking specifically to Fish, Wildlife, or limiting my question to Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, because you deal with a lot of other entities.
Well, in my opinion, Brian, if you look at fisheries management of Flathead Lake, which began in the late 90s, and we solidified a plan in 2000 that was supposed to be a 10-year plan, and it brought together stakeholders from throughout the Flathead Lake area, tribal members, fishermen, non-fishermen, people that were affected by what the fish species were in Flathead Lake. And we got to look back at how lake trout got into Flathead Lake. They were illegally introduced in 1920, brought over from the Great Lakes, such as Lake Michigan and Superior.
You said illegally.
Illegally. Yeah. We did not request lake trout in Flathead Lake.
And they're not obvious. They're obviously non-native.
They are a non-native fish species to western
yes.
Montana. Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And then you got to look at what happened in the 80s when the state of Montana illegally introduced Mysis shrimp. Now, Mysis shrimp were a food source for the lake trout, and they started to populate and boom and eat everything else that was in the lake to the point of extinction.
Why were they introduced?
You know, that's a question you're going to have to ask State Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. I was in high school at the time, and now we're dealing with the ramifications of the Mysis shrimp in terms of we want to restore native bull trout and West Slope cutthroat, and here's the reason why. You lose those native fish species, you lose your identity as a people, as a tribe. Those two fish species were very important to the Salish, the Kootenai, the Pend'oreille, and Kalispell people that make up the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes of Flathead Indian Reservation. And
important how?
Culturally important. There are stories that were taught from our ancestors from the elders to our children about the bull trout, about West Slope cutthroat trout. And I can't really share those. Those are private stories.
Interesting.
But they are stories nonetheless. And it's part of your culture. It's part of your heritage of who you are as a people, and individually those are very important. You bring in a species that is very difficult to catch, in my opinion. You need to have large boats most of the time to fish for lake trout. They're a deep water species,
yeah.
And you got to have the lines, the downriggers, the fish finders. You know, you can catch lake trout off the docks at certain times of the year. Fall is an example of that, where our MAC days, I wouldn't call it a celebration, but it's a MAC days fishing derby.
Okay, uh-huh.
Where we want individual anglers and people to come and catch lake trout. And we provide prizes, cash prizes. Fishing poles, fishing gear, many different things. A lot of fish are tagged that might be worth $100. Well, I mean, we had to let one go, but that was worth $10,000 a few years ago.
Okay, but the point you were making was this species is important, the two species, culturally to your people.
Mm-hmm.
Lake trout are illegally introduced, and there's conflict around it. In other words, there was the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks perspective, and I'll summarize it, and I might be misstating it, but I have no axe to grind in this. They're there. It helps the local economy because tourists come to catch the fish.
Some.
There's room for both. Okay, I think that's the argument.
That's their opinion, and from the tribal perspective, especially our fisheries managers, will never eradicate the lake trout from Flathead Lake. We don't believe it. That will ever happen. We want to reduce the numbers to bring back the bulls and West Slope cutthroat trout. Yes, it helps the economy in a certain aspect, but it's only for a few charter boat fishermen that have made their living on it ever since the mid-80s when they noticed lake trout are more abundant. Not many of us locally will use charter boats. We just don't. We don't fish for lake trout.
Okay, but my question, I was going to get back to your point because I want to explore it. You've indicated you can't share the stories, but clearly the stories matter to at least a group of people in the tribes, the leadership of the tribes.
Correct.
You're a representative of the tribal mm-hmm. council, enough that the tribe's position was very strong. I'm speaking as a neutral mediator. To one degree or another, we can tolerate lake trout, but we are committed to protection and enhancement of bull trout as culturally important to our people.
Correct.
Now, someone might say, why? We're living in the 21st century. Those are old stories. The world's a changed place. Why does it still matter?
You can say the same thing, Brian, as why does the Bible matter? Why does history in the past matter to any race of people? I'm part German. You know, why does that matter? I mean, it matters to all cultures in today's world, especially if you lose something that connects you to the world, the land. I mean, the bottom line, I guess I can say, is I believe the economy with the influx of bulls and cuts will be even better in the future because most people will be able to go out and fish for the bulls and the cuts and do quite well. We'll get more people coming to the area to fish. For example, when we became co-licensees of former Kerr Dam, now Salish and Kootenai Dam, we stopped the dam from being a fluctuating facility. It means when they needed power, they threw water out.
Right.
When they didn't, they would hold it. Now the continuous flow is more follows a natural hydrograph to where the fish species below Salish Kootenai Dam have come back in such a way that we get people coming there to fish for trout that haven't been there in the last 10 years, but now they're very abundant. And other species such as smallmouth bass, which were introduced.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Rich Jansen, who is department head of the Natural Resources Department for the Federated Salish and Kootenai Tribes. I guess what I'm asking is a philosophical question. I'm familiar with the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Management in Montana. I was on the California Fish and Game Commission. And economic use and generating revenue for the state, not just state government, but for the economy, is one of the factors that's weighed significantly in management decisions. And what I'm trying to figure out in your seat with the people you represent and the tribal history you represent, if it's the same or different.
We're the same, but with the influx of modern technologies, assimilation into the dominant society, there are some things that we have been taught by the federal government or state governments on how to survive. If you're looking at lake trout versus bull trout and West Slope cutthroat, yes, we do sell our permits right now to non-members to come in and fish, if they so choose. That's their choice. The economy, in my opinion, you know, would do just as well, if not better, if we had more individuals able to come onto the reservation and fish for bull trout and West Slope cutthroat.
All right, I hear you, and you mentioned that before. Let's look at timber. If the way you manage timber, is it the same as, let's say, the Forest Service or state lands in Montana? In other words, again, I'm looking at the question of commodity use in the traditional utilitarian, quote, Western sense, and tribal use, because tribal people say commonly They have a history of being closer to the land. They used the land. They would start forest fires to improve habitat, etc., so they would manipulate land. But the perception, and it is one I've heard from Native people quite often, is there's a higher, I mean my language, higher respect for the land and a less of a willingness to what I will call short-term exploitation at the jeopardy of the health of the land. Now, am I...
Yes, you're correct. I mean...
How does that manifest itself in your world, if at all?
Well, you know, again, Brian, we were taught how to manage timber resources on our reservation by the federal government, the BIA. I was a trained forester at the University of Montana, and I looked at my role in terms of managing that resource for the benefit of seven generations down the road. And so what that meant is, you know, I didn't want to do clear cuts unless absolutely necessary. And that was where species such as lodgepole pine, that's how they were mimicked right. In the past was large-scale fires. And so if you left lodgepole pine, they would fall over anyway. What we've done now, we're not doing so much of the square-type clear cuts. It's ecosystem management. It's a function that you try to mimic how the land looks and how fire would have an effect on the timber resources, and then enhancing wildlife species while protecting the hydrology of the streams and the rivers to keep sediment out, to build the roads correctly with the proper culverts. We have a lot of foresters that are trained, professional foresters that are tribal members now, and we're doing a pretty good job because we work with the forestry department to ensure that timber resource will be around for a long time. And now that there's more and more fires, climate changes here, in my opinion, we're going to be into the woods more often than not, because without fire, you know, we get a forest that is unhealthy.
Hey, what I'm asking, that sounds, if I could be sitting across from a guy in the U.S. Forest Service right now with the same, it seems to me, philosophy of environmentally guided intervention. Fair?
Fair.
Because the Forest Service has changed.
They have changed in the last 20 years, yes.
Let's take a look at one other traditional resource industry, mining. What's the tribe's attitude from your department's standpoint, a tribal perspective on mining on the reservation?
Well, mining on the reservation, and our perspective is this one. We're not against mining. We're against mining that degrades the resource, including water quality issues. That's what I would tell you, Brian.
Okay.
For example, if you look at the Elk River Mining Complex that's in Canada, British Columbia and Alberta.
Therefore off the reservation.
Yes, off the reservation, but eventually could impact our waters.
Through down river flows?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's going on with that? I'm just not familiar with it.
Well, we're looking at the impacts of selenium in the wildlife, the impacts of those on bird eggs, the impacts to the fish species in western Montana. I mean, water flows downhill. It doesn't know boundaries. You know, so what one country allows definitely affects other countries, especially if it's mining that might not be using the most sound science to get a permit to be able to start exploring or expanding mines.
So I'm hearing you say you're concerned that these mines may negatively impact water quality on the reservation.
Correct.
It's off the reservation. What do you do about it?
What do we do about it? Well, Aboriginal territory, we look to the U.S. government, meaning the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which has trust responsibility to protect the waters of the U.S. and waters of the tribe. And we've reached out to them. They have allowed us to monitor on a group that was looking at the company that wants to expand those mines, and they're keeping us informed. They've even come over to the council meetings and talk to our tribal council or tribal leaders to let them know what is transpiring. I don't think it's over. The population is booming in the world economy. People need those fossil fuels to work right now. We're a ways away of having the electric cars be commonplace, or things like the Prius. I mean, they're just very difficult, and not a lot of people can afford them. But the bottom line is, we don't want our resources now to be degraded. And I think the state of Montana should think the same way.
Okay, so it's Canadian mines, and you're working with the EPA, but the Canadians control the outcome. What's the outcome you're looking for?
Well, the outcome we're looking for is we want the U.S. side and the Canadian side to work together, state of Montana, the provinces of Alberta and British Columbia, to work with the federal government to come up with some sort of solution to ensure that the water's not degraded. To me, if they degrade Canadian waters, it's going to come downhill and degrade U.S. waters as well.
One way to do it is stop the mine. The second is potentially change mining practices. What are you advocating?
I'm advocating changing the mining practices to maybe invest more dollars to ensure that, you know, the settling ponds don't contain so much heavy metals that could be potentially dangerous to the resources.
Which brings us around in an interesting way to the purpose of this conference. It says you're holding this conference, connecting people to sustain and enhance culture, community, and conservation. Your work world and the examples we've just talked about in terms of bull trout, lake trout, and this mine illustrate the human reality of overlaying multiple jurisdictions, different priorities, et cetera, where nature just is beyond those boundaries. It's a whole, an interconnected whole. As a professional, you've been at this a while, I ask you this question. Is this stuff about bringing people together to solve these kind of problems pie in the sky, or can it work?
It can work, Brian. I have no doubt, and I'm very optimistic that it has to work. The world is a changing place. The world is growing daily. We're populating the world, and the land masses are shrinking. If we don't work together for the benefit of all of us, whatever the issue is, it's going to be very devastating. And, you know, I just firmly believe that bringing people together to solve or find solutions for common problems, it benefits us all in the long run. And for me, it benefits the seven generations that I'm looking out to in the future.
Rich Jansen, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.